Welcome to the Christadelphian Classics podcast, brought to you by Wilderness Voice. Principles and Proverbs by Iflip Collier. Part 2, Proverbs, chapter 17. Rebuke a wise man, and he will love thee. Have you ever met such a wise man? The saying is obviously implies that a rebuke is needed and that it is given in the right spirit. But even so, we find it difficult to think of men who will properly appreciate its value when they are the subject of it. Experience shows that all men hate to be censured, and those that say they do not object to hostile criticism are usually the most impatient of all. Few men can accept a reproof in the true spirit of Christian humility, and even some who can be helped by criticism nevertheless feel resentment against the critic. If we desire to be wise, we must clearly try to escape from this natural reaction, for it is as evil as many other natural things. The Apostle Peter suggests that even if we learn to accept reproof with meekness, there is no credit due to us as if such reproof is deserved. It's only when we're meek in the affliction of unjust condemnation that we've accomplished something of value. This seems rather a hard saying, but it's good to bear it in mind, for there is so much possibility of faulty self-judgment in this matter. Some men never seem conscious of being in the wrong. They'll admit the abstract possibility of error, will perhaps, with a display of abstract humility, state that they have often been faulty, but it is never in the particular matter in which they are called in question. The fact of being accused seems to call up reserves of defensive argument that swamp all capacity for sane self-judgment. The more they think of the criticism, the greater the flood of self-justification, and the blacker the appearance of the one who has dared to condemn. If such men are quite incapable of perceiving the fault of the moment, it's good for them to remember the Apostle Peter's words, and then they may try to be patient, although unconscious of error. A forced meekness in the face of attack may have the unfortunate effect of endowing them with a particularly harmful kind of subjective halo, but it will at least keep them cool. And while they are cool, reason may have a chance to enter. Presently, the matter in question will slip into the past, and they are prepared to admit that they may have made a few mistakes in former days, so perchance this may rank among them. It's only the present tense that is always perfect. One of the most remarkable examples in Scripture of a man being meek in the face of fierce criticism is that of David in exile. He accepted the criticism, the curse of Shimei, as something well deserved. He refused to retaliate or allow his servants to strike a blow on his behalf. He neither forgot nor forgave, however. Of course, no man, however wise, could be expected to love such a critic as this, for although in a sense it was true that God had sent Shimei to curse David, he did not come either with the right message or the right motive. He was only one of many wicked men whose evil conduct brought the divinely decreed punishment upon the erring king, just as other wicked men have on a larger scale worked the divine purpose with nations. David recognized this truth and so was humble in the face of unjust accusation. Kings have not often been meek in such circumstances. Usually, they're so surrounded by flatterers that adverse criticism is very rarely heard, and when it does find a path to the throne, it is represented as the treason of enemies. It must be extremely difficult for a king to understand his errors. There's an opposite danger for prominent men who are exposed to the full fire of criticism. They are obliged to develop some protective mental armour or they'd be overwhelmed. Even in the brotherhood this is true, and one does not have to be very prominent to find it so. A naturally sensitive man would have his feelings so lacerated that his power for work would fail unless he was in some measure to become indifferent to criticism. Here lies his peculiar danger, fully expressed by that word, indifferent. He may ignore scores of ill-tempered and foolish letters without hating anyone or feeling any resentment against the misguided writers, and then with this growth of tolerance, he may equally ignore the most faithful of reproofs or the wisest of constructive criticism. Thus, he neither hates the foolish detractors nor loves the wise reprover. He ignores them all. When it is impossible to pay attention to everyone, it's sometimes difficult to pick and choose. The first step toward overcoming any danger, however, is to be aware of it, and it should not be difficult in this matter to take the first step. Aware of the danger of being case-hardened against all kinds of reproof, we shall at least make an attempt to discriminate between friend and foe, for even if there is only one wise man among a thousand, we desire to pay heed to that solitary wise man. Equally, do we desire to prove our own wisdom by loving him for his reproofs. This ideal of being meek and even grateful in the presence of rebuke may be applied in a wider sense than we have yet considered. The principle surely holds good when there's no visible reprover but only the rod of circumstance. As the Apostle says, "No chastening for the present seemeth to be joyous, but grievous. Nevertheless, afterward, it yieldeth the peaceable fruit of righteousness to them which are exercised thereby." One who is wise enough to love a faithful reprover will surely be exercised aright by apparent adverse circumstance. We have repeated assurance of divine control in the lives of the faithful servants of God. The brief but intimate records of Scripture show us how often the apparent triumph of evil has been divinely regulated for the development of character in righteous men and women. The Apostle tells us that all things work together for good to them that love God and are called according to His purpose. Circumstance often gives us some hard blows. How are we exercised by such chastening? There may be no visible reprover to love or hate, but there is ample scope for our reactions either way. Sometimes men are more embittered by the adverse experience. Their ambitions have been thwarted, their hopes disappointed, their feelings lacerated, and they become resentful and morose. If they claim to be servants of God, they will, of course, not admit that they're guilty of the folly of reproaching Him, but that is really what it amounts to. How else can such an attitude be interpreted if it's recognized that the divine hand plays a part in our lives? It is bad to become apathetic or develop a pagan brand of stoicism, but it's even worse to become querulous and complaining. We must learn to be sad without being bitter, to be tired without being despondent, and to be humble without being weak. It is not good to make a parade of presumptuous confidence that God is regulating everything in our lives, but it is good in the hidden recesses of our own minds to recognize the fact that as there is nothing too great for God to accomplish, so there is nothing too small for Him to see. Even the trifling vexations of life may play a part in forming us. If God takes note of us at all, there can be nothing in our experience so small as to be insignificant. Our finite distinctions between great and small would seem lost in the presence of the infinite. Even from the point of view of a human being, it's obvious that our conceptions of great and small may be completely mistaken. Viewed in retrospect, the events of life change their meaning. Some incidents which hardly excited any attention at the time of their occurrence are seen to have had a far greater effect than some of the apparently important issues which once exercised us so much. This idea was suggested by Kipling when he wrote, "If you can meet with triumph or disaster and treat those two impostors just the same." Until the final judgment is passed, we do not know which are the triumphs and which are the disasters of life, or whether indeed of the words is appropriate for any of our experiences. There has been no disaster in our lives if the Lord approves at the end, while as for triumph, that is surely his rather than ours. The words of the poet are not adequate, however well they sound, yet we may draw a lesson from them. If a semi-pagan ideal of manhood should cut out all complaints and vain regrets, how much more should a living faith in God teach us to struggle on with cheerful confidence, always remembering that the sternest of critics or the hardest of circumstances may best evoke our gratitude? A test for our wisdom is to be able to accept reproof, whether it comes from a candid friend or from the circumstances of life. A still higher test is in being able to love the friend for his candor and for the tribulation of adverse circumstance to increase our love for God.